Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our September Artist of the Month, Ben Diley, co-founded the Lemonheads in the mid-80s with his high school friend Evan Dando. After a trio of records that featured Ben and Evan sharing songwriting and lead vocal duties, Ben left the group just prior to its mainstream breakthrough to pursue a degree in English at Harvard University. But after graduating and embarking upon a successful career in advertising, he's stayed musically active with bands such as Pods and Varsity Drag. And most recently, he's reconnected with his Lemonheads past, overseeing deluxe reissues of the band's first three albums. I got a chance to talk with Ben at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after sharing a bill with Varsity Drag in my role as guitar player in The Parasites, and we'll be hearing that conversation over the next hour. But first, here's a track from a live Varsity Drag radio performance on WFMO in October 2009, available for download from varsitydrag.bandcamp.com, called Skinny Ties.
I give up all of my skinny ties. Give up cheese, omelets, and curly fries. I drive faster, though it's courting disaster. I maintain the spirit of compromise. I find a brand new way. I'd skip my birthday. I'd change all the words of the songs I play. I would throw it all away. I just had to let you know I could never let you go. I give up beer, give up rock and roll. Polish what's left of my immortal soul. I change geography, give up pornography. Leave all my guitars out in the cold. No need to tell you why, when all these years go by. Remember when I said I won't let it die. I would throw it all away. I just had to let you know I could never let you go.
Well, hi, Ben. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
What's your musical background like? Did you come from a musical family?
Yeah, definitely. My mom was a music teacher, among other things. She was also a special needs teacher and had various kind of specialized training in dealing with kids with dyslexia and that sort of stuff. But she was also very musical, came from a musical family. My grandmother was very musical. I got a picture of me and her when I'm a tiny little baby sitting on her lap and we're both playing the piano. So in that way, I was very lucky that I was always surrounded by instruments and people singing and people playing music. So basically, it's just simply a matter of picking up a guitar that would be lying on the floor and plunking around on it. And I've come to appreciate with the years just how what a profound difference that makes in a life because, for instance, Lisa, my bandmate in Varsity Drag, and my wife, grew up in a house that didn't have a lot of musical interest going on. And so it's one of those things where you can easily end up with an idea that there are certain people who are quote unquote musical and other people who aren't, and that maybe you're not one of them.
Right.
But obviously it's just a question of being exposed to it. Cause I've seen for a fact that anybody, absolutely anybody can pick up a guitar or a recorder or a piano if they're young enough. And then lo and behold, they're quote unquote talented. Mm. Yeah.
You formed the Lemonheads in high school. When did you first meet Evan?
Evan and I probably met in 82, 83. Yeah, we went to high school together. It was my first year as a freshman. I think it was his second year as a freshman. And one or the other of us was standing in one of the little lobbies in our high school quoting from this absurdist 70s comedy troupe called the Firesign Theater.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Don't crush that dwarf.
Exactly. So one of us was doing, I can't remember which, was doing a routine, and the other one heard it and chimed in and started doing the same one. So we were like, ah, we're simpatico. We went to a very small high school, tiny, weird little place.
Where was this?
It was called the Commonwealth School. It's in Boston, okay. At the corner of Comm Ave and Dartmouth. And it was founded by Charles Merrill of the Merrill Lynch Merrills, presumably as a way to give back so much that they had taken from society. So, you know, a really interesting man and a great school. And it just so happened that at the time that we were there, a kid who was a senior when we were freshmen was a major sort of punk rock enthusiast. Mm-hmm. And one of his best buddies who was in our class was as well. So right off the bat, we had two friends who were self-described record collector scum and who kind of had all of the awesome music of the day and would have whatever cassettes of obscure things that nobody else had. And so that was kind of our feeder of awesome music. I mean, especially of stuff beyond just 77 punk, which yeah. was easier to get a hold of and more widely known. But I mean, actually, I'm thinking, like, for instance, I think Evan has a story about one of the teachers at Commonwealth introducing him to Big Star. Mm. So, I mean, it was a place that definitely encouraged music and eccentricity and that kind of stuff. So I think we started playing music together probably in 85, and it was just the two of us. And as I'm fond of saying, Congress had not yet passed the historic White Stripes Act legalizing two-person bands. So we were like, well, we're not really a band. And we recorded some stuff on 4-track, and unfortunately it's lost. But we recorded a couple songs on 4-track just as this two-piece yeah. swapping back and forth. And we were like, well, we need a bass player or else we won't be able to be street legal as a band. And a good friend of ours who was also into the same music as us, Jesse, also happened to be one of the only people we knew who owned a bass because he played in the jazz band. Mm. So he was a natural choice for bass player. And it turned out, again, he had and still has a natural affinity for schmoozing and hustling and doing stuff like that that basically was the secret to any early success we had was due to Jesse having the right relationships and knowing who to ask for things and just being really good at that and really right. relentless about it. And Evan and I would just kind of sit back with the glazed eyes, you know, trying to handle the music half of things.
Yeah.
But it was a good combo. And I think when we recorded our very first real recordings, literally a couple days after we graduated high school in 86, and by that fall we had put out our first EP. Curtis Casella from Tang heard it and asked us to sign with him for, I guess, 3 records. So we were sort of off and running quickly in that regard.
From the Lemonheads' debut EP, 1986's Laughing All the Way to the Cleaners, here's a song called So I Fucked Up.
So I fucked up, I believe it was so I fucked up. I know the bad thing you do and then I fucked up. What do you want? Said I was sorry, wouldn't help, I said it again. So I fucked up, I believe it was so I fucked up. I did the best I could do but then I fucked up. What do you want?
Were you touring a lot at this time? Were you getting radio play?
We were definitely getting a lot of Boston radio play. Again, I think that it's difficult for you kids out there who might be listening to grasp what the world was like before the internet. You know, basically the only way people would hear about new music was either through your local undergroundy record store, mm-hmm. underground zines, and or a college radio station that played local bands. Yeah. And we were lucky that Boston had a couple of the best college stations in the country. And we got on a few playlists there and got played a fair amount. And that definitely helped. We were not touring because we were all in school. Mm. Well, okay, that's not entirely accurate. I think the first tour we ever did was, again, it was a couple of weeks, summer of 87. And we did another couple of weeks, summer of 88, I think. Mm. So ostensibly, each of those years, there was an album from Tang. And each of those years, we did some kind of tour of mostly the Midwest.
Right.
But yeah, not a lot of touring, mostly focusing on school and our lives here. I think at that point, again, no one, certainly least of all me, was taking very seriously the idea of this being a band that was a, I mean, my God, like certainly not a career choice yeah. type thing. I mean, it was just very much, it was a fun thing to do with friends.
When listening to those first 3 Lemonheads records, there's a very eclectic sound to it. Like some of the songs have kind of that melodic hardcore Replacements or Husker Du thing. But then there are acoustic songs, there are poppier songs. Did you ever feel like there was a Lemonhead sound, or were you just doing whatever felt right?
I think that, as is often the case with that kind of thing, whatever we did sort of ex post facto becomes the Lemonhead sound. So it clearly was a sound that was distinctive. And I think, as is also almost always the case, we certainly weren't self-consciously setting out to create anything. We were just sort of writing the songs that we happened to be writing at that moment. I think that collectively, when you have a group of people sort of sharing the duty of arranging songs, you will end up with a certain kind of aesthetic that ends up governing it, because songs will end up having a certain kind of feel within a range. I mean, the interesting thing about the acoustic song was the first ever Lemonhead's acoustic song was on the second album.
Postcard.
And there was a lot of internal controversy regarding whether that song would be put on the album. And one of the quotations I remember from a band member was something like, are you fucking kidding me? An acoustic song? What are the skinheads and what are the kids at the All Ages shows going to say about a band doing an acoustic song like that? And we were like, hey, here comes a regular, you know?
Right.
Screw you. I mean, we were in an odd place of straddling the world of the hardcore scene in Boston at that time, which were, again, a lot of the bands that we play with, but also dealing with the fact that our biggest influences were 77 punk bands, 70s rock bands, The Replacements, Husker Du, Descendants to some degree. We didn't set out to be this way, but we found that we didn't slot neatly into the hardcore scene, but that definitely that's where we played a lot of shows and got invited to play. And when there ended up being this genre that was designated college rock, which now they call indie rock or whatever it is, that sort of gave us a place to be, and it gave us a place where people could figure out where to put us on playlists and radio stations and stuff. And that was a genre designation that was capacious enough to include people banging out acoustic songs.
From the Lemonheads' 1988 sophomore album, Creator, this is Postcard.
Once I thought I was more right than wrong, painting myself in the corner. What I bought and why did it take so long? Something inside of her warned her. I know that it doesn't matter much, but I hope we'll keep in touch. I know that we won't go on as such, but I hope we'll keep in touch. Fragile smile or ragged sleeve, didn't laugh once too often. For a while it takes to grieve, try to repair what I've done. I know that it doesn't matter much, but I hope keep in touch. I know that we won't go on as such, we'll be right back.
And again, I think that's all due to the Replacements, that we wanted to do that in the first place,
sure.
But that also we felt emboldened to do it and didn't feel like we had to adhere to some particular formula, right. Except the Replacements formula.
Where it's okay to do the Kiss cover.
Exactly. We would slavishly, apparently, I think move for move, we definitely found ourselves doing a lot of that stuff just because we love them so much and we're inspired. And I mean, same with Husker Du. I mean, certainly for me, our first album, I'm playing the guitar, basically the bottom three strings, and that's it. Or rather, I guess it's the top three strings. It looks like the bottom when you're looking at it from point of view of the guy playing the guitar. So I just kind of slide my fingers up and down this kind of bar chord shape. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to play Ramones songs, right. And Angry Samoan songs. And sometime around the time we were writing the second record, I discovered the drone via Husker Du. I was like, holy crap, I can put more fingers on more parts of the guitar, and then I can let those bottom strings ring out, and it makes this awesome Bob Mould sound. So then, you know, drone everywhere
right. On
all the songs. So you can sort of hear us discovering little influences along the way. Also, for some reason, Evan and I, we were roommates at that time. We lived together for a couple of years, and we were listening to a lot of Sabbath. And listening to Kiss, too. Mm-hmm. And some of that crept in there, too. So
from 1989's Lick, the third and final album Ben recorded with the Lemonheads, here's a song called Ever.
Decide that you were going to leave the band?
I was actually just talking about this with Todd Phillips, drummer for, well, current Lemonheads drummer, former drummer for Juliana Hatfield III and Bolt La Volta. And oh my God, we loved Bolt La Volta. We toured with them. We worshipped them. We loved seeing their shows. They had these electrifying, amazing shows. But anyway, I was sitting having drinks with Todd and with Kurt, a.k.a. Yucky Guype, who was the singer for Bolt La Volta. I hadn't seen him in years and years, but we were remembering this trip that we took to State College, Pennsylvania, and maybe a few other places in this big school bus they had. And actually, the performance that we did in State College is on YouTube. I think it's called No Raymond Burrs, and it's basically the whole show. And at that point, the configuration was Evan was playing drums, Corey and I were playing guitar, Jesse was playing bass. But I remember that tour because I remember I was studying for finals and I was on the bus studying for finals and somebody in the band was busting my chops about, like, what the hell are you doing? This isn't rock and roll. Why are you studying for this stuff? Come on. It's sort of usual epithets that have been lobbed at me since I was very little. Painful phrases like uptight or stick in the mud. Mm. I remember realizing on that tour that it was just incompatible, that basically the level of seriousness that was starting to be there in the band was incompatible with how I wanted to live my life, because I had certainly never dreamed of being in a rock band that traveled a lot and played a lot. I was very much a homebody, and maybe less so now, but certainly at that point in my life, I wanted nothing more than to be in one place with my books and my stuff and always wake up in the same place. And I definitely wanted to be in school and I wanted to be very serious about studying. And it was all just sort of getting to be too much. And after that tour, final nail in the coffin was I had been working hard with a professor at the college I was going to get into this symposium on William Butler Yeats that was happening in Sligo. And I think she had to write me a letter of recommendation or something. But anyway, I was greenlit to go to this thing in Sligo. The band was talking about this first European tour. And they were like, well, you know, we're already getting the tickets and these are the dates. And I was like, I can't go. Going to this thing in Sligo is way more important to me than running around Europe playing punk rock. And so, you know, that was it. That was the actual end.
From a 1993 radio performance by Pods on WMBR, available at pods.bandcamp.com, here's a song featuring William Butler Yeats' poem When You Are Old, that Ben set to music called Crowd of Stars.
When you were old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once. Run out the shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace, loved your beauty with love false so true. When one man loved the pilgrim soul in you, loved the sorrows on your changing face. Beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars.
It was soon after that that the Lemonheads really took off. It doesn't seem like it was an acrimonious departure, but was there that sort of Pete Best, my friends are on the cover of Rolling Stone now?
I mean, I guess there was, to the degree that everyone in my life tried their level-headed best to make it be that story. Mm. I think that for some reason it's very, very difficult to make the average person understand that not everybody wants to play rock and roll for a living. The default assumption that everybody wants certain things, you know, everybody loves tall, busty, blue-eyed blondes, and everybody loves sunny, cloudless days, and everybody wants to be a rock star. I'm like, basically all I can do is sort of nod and smile and be like, sure, whatever. Yeah, no, I mean, there's certainly no avoiding the fact that for a little while there, Lemonheads were ubiquitous, and everybody that I knew would come sort of knocking on my door, and I'd be studying or working on my silly thesis, and they'd be like, oh my God, you see this? Lemonheads. Like, yes, I know. What would you like me to do about it? You know? Would you like me to get you some autographs? But the other thing is the circumstances of my life leading up to leaving the band, and certainly subsequent to leaving the band. The woman that I was living with, who eventually I married, detested rock and roll and detested all the people in the band for various quite justifiable reasons. My family did not care for the people in the band or for rock and roll or for the rock and roll lifestyle. And so basically my entire world that I lived in was made up of people who were very glad that I wasn't doing rock and roll anymore. So it was just always something that would come drifting in from the outside. It would generally be someone who didn't know me very well being like, oh my God, you see your old band is on the cover of it. He's like, yeah, I saw it. Well, don't you think that you should? No, no. Do you see what I'm doing now? This is what I want to be doing. So there it is. There are those out there who will understand because they wanted to do things with their life and had a sense of their own values. And I guess then there's other people who it would be unkind to suggest that they received all of their values from pop culture. But let's just say there are other people out there who have more conventional sense of what it is they wanted to do with their life who probably think, oh, my God, that's crazy. Why wouldn't you stay in the band? And I would say 10 months of tour in a year. That is what is expected, you know, if this band is going to become a serious, real working band. Tour like 9-10 months of the year. And I was like, I'm out. That's it. Living with a person that I loved who I want to wake up with every day and being, at that point, perhaps ludicrously serious about my literary studies and serious young man. I'm like, yeah, come on. It's childish. And I want to have a real life. I mean, the interesting thing now, looking back from a gajillion years later, I can see where if I had been more inclined towards a sense of fun and freedom and more sort of expansive, like, yeah, what the hell? I probably could have ridden it for another couple of years. But I can pretty much guarantee that had I done that, the band would not have been successful in the way that they were because it was that single-minded focus on Evan and on one songwriter's songs and one face representing the band that really gave it that hook that I think all that cultural salience came from. I think if we had attempted to continue to be, you know, this two-headed band, I don't think there's any way they would have been the mainstream success that there was. So that kind of paradoxically is yet another reason why it's good for everyone that I wasn't there. Because I don't think it would have happened if I had been there.
While you were going to Harvard, you also started a band called Pods?
Yeah, this is my younger brother who was the serious musician in the family. For instance, he went to this performing arts high school, Walnut Hill, that was like the kids in the Fame movie, you know, dancing on the tables and doing big musical numbers at lunchtime spontaneously. Yeah, he really wanted to play music with me. He had watched Lemonheads exist because we rehearsed in the basement of our house. And so he had seen us from a very young age. And actually, at one point when we were without a drummer or between drummers, he played a couple of gigs with us, I think. So he saw me unattached to a band. It was like, come on, man, come on. We're brothers, let's play. Let's do some music. And I said, well, as long as it doesn't take me away, as long as I don't have to go on tour, as long as I don't have to devote an inordinate amount of time, absolutely. So we had our sort of weekend warrior thing doing Pods. And again, because of local radio, because of the fact that Boston is such a great town for music, we definitely enjoyed some local success and spent a lot of time on playlists of the various local radio stations. There's a commercial station, the one commercial station that kind of played alternative music back then, WFNX. And they played us a lot, and they'd have us come on and play live, and the college station, same thing. And, you know, we played the Rock and Roll Rumble, which was a big deal back then in Boston, and, you know, basically were comfortably ensconced as, you know, a local act. I think we played in New York a couple of few times. We went down as far as Baltimore, I think. Basically, we were in Boston, and it was strictly a weekends thing. And when I moved to California in 1995, I was like, yeah, well, sorry, guys, you know, I must go. So that was the end of that.
Here's the lead-off track from Pod's only full-length album, 1994's Where I'm Calling From, called Promise.
Your door, the shadows there.
Varsity Drag startup.
Some guys in California who were fans of my Lemonhead stuff and also of Pods, which they had discovered somehow, which this was fledgling internet days. This is like Prodigy, AOL days. Yeah. So there was the Usenet. It had message boards. And so back then, punk rockers could, in fact, begin to share information across long distances. And they got in touch with me. I believe it was on AOL. They got in touch with me and they said, hey, we were a few towns over from you. I was living in Berkeley and they were up in San Rafael. And they said, we have this band, Unbalanced. We're big fans. Will you come and see our show? So I was like, yeah, sure. So I went to see them play. They were great. They were sort of drunken replacements-y sort of thing. It was very much my speed. And talked to them afterwards and I was like, yeah, you guys are great. And I think a little while after that, they made the approach like, well, do you want to come down to our rehearsal space sometime and hang out? Maybe we could play a little. And I was like, eh, what the hell? Sure, fine. You know, I'm working at, by then I had my first sort of real agency job. And so I was like, yeah, you know, what the heck? I could play some music. That'd be fun. And we ended up setting up this routine. I think every Sunday morning we'd get breakfast and then we'd play for a couple hours at the rehearsal space, which was a shipping container in a parking lot right next to San Quentin prison. And there were a couple other shipping containers there, all of which were wired with electricity and had carpeting in them and were rented as band spaces for rehearsal. So it was kind of like insane cacophony you would hear from all the neighboring shipping containers. But it was a fun scene. There was like a little porta potty and people would have hibachis and Webers and would be grilling and stuff outside of their shipping container. I think we were sharing a shipping container with a band on Fat Wreck called Bracket. I can't remember. Anyway, so, you know, lo and behold, I found myself playing with these guys every week or so, and we actually started writing songs. And the next thing you know, we're like, oh, yeah, we've got a show. I think it was Bracket set up a show for us to play. And I was like, oh, boy, here we go. So we played, and again, it was very much, it was understood that we were staying in San Francisco, a sort of weekend warrior, yuppie hobby type affair. We had fun. We played a couple shows, ended up making some recordings in the shipping container.
Okay.
Which became the basis of the first Varsity Drag record. Then we all ended up going our separate ways right around the sort of millennium tech bubble crash.
Dot-com thing.
We sort of called it off. And what happened was some guy in England, a very nice band named Aston, who has a record label called Boss Tunage, somehow heard our recordings, because all I had ever done with them was I made some homemade CDs and gave them to people at Christmas. And I guess it got distributed somehow to this guy, and he heard it, and he started writing to me. He was like, hey, you know, I really want to put out your band's record. And I was like, well, there isn't really a band, but sure, that sounds like fun. And 6 months would go by, and he'd write to me again and be like, I'm not kidding, I really do want to put this out. Can we do this? And I was like, yeah, totally, totally. And then another year went by, and he'd write to me again. I'd be like, hey, come on, you know, let's do this. And I think it took probably 4 years, something like that. And finally, I was like, okay. So I sent him the recordings on a CDR a couple of months after that. He said, dude, I really need artwork. You know, I can't do this without artwork. It's like, fine. So I found an art director who was willing to put together CD art. And after me being basically useless for a bunch of years, Aston got all the assets and he put it all together and he released a CD.
From Varsity Drag's debut release, 2006's For Crying Out Loud, here's a song that pays tribute to a legendary fixture on the Boston music scene, Billy Ruane.
250 cc's rolling down Mass Avenue. Sicko sun is flashing down, taillights barely hanging on. You know and I know that it's been way too long. Where are you going, stranger? Better hang on. Though the dance is never ending, wanna see your friends tonight. That suit might need a cleaning, but it's alright. But the place just ain't the same without Billy Ruane. Cause he always knows your name. And it's just a goddamn shame without Billy Ruane. And there ain't no
is never ending. I wanna see your face tonight. That suit might need a cleaning, but it's alright. But the place just ain't the same without Billy Ruane. Cause he always knows your name, that Billy Ruane. And it's just a crying shame without Billy Ruane. And there ain't no one to blame, but the place just ain't the same. Keep it loud, keep it raw. The best dressed drunk I ever saw.
Probably 5 or 6 months after that, got a email or some communication from a guy in Germany who's like, hey, I love this Fosse drag record. We want to set up a tour. You guys come to Europe.
At that point, there's no band?
There's no band at that point, yeah. But a tour offer sitting there and a CD out in the world. And so, I started reaching out to people, and it was pretty clear that our original other guitarist wasn't going to be able to make it happen, and our bass player, who's a vice principal of an elementary school for various reasons, job-related and family-related, said, I can't do this either. Mm. Our drummer's already over in Europe. So he said, yeah, sure, fine. So at that point, Lisa, my wife, had, I think, maybe cripes a few months earlier than that, for her birthday, she had asked for a bass, and so she had a bass, and she was dicking around with this bass. And I said, hey, I think you're going to need to be a bass player for Varsity Drag, so here's a bunch of songs to learn. And she, again, to my endless amazement, and let everybody out there, again, whoever thinks, I'm not musical, you've been hornswoggled, the wool has been pulled over your eyes, because Lisa, who really hadn't played much music in her life, or certainly not since high school, basically taught herself to play the bass in, I don't know, like 4 weeks, 6 weeks, and learned all these songs. And so we were kind of getting ready to do this, and then basically at the 11th hour, our original bass player called up and said, no, wait, actually, I can do it. So obviously there was, a little bit of bruised up feelings and a period of readjustment around that, but basically we met up in Portland, Maine. We rehearsed for a couple few days, and then everybody went back home, and then we met to begin the tour in Germany a couple weeks after that, I think. And Lisa, to her great credit, came along anyway and basically helped keep everything together. She was sort of videographer of the whole thing. We have about 21 hours of HD footage of this tour, which someday we'll make an hilarious documentary, which I probably will never have time to do anything with. But if anybody out there is an aspiring documentarian who wants this footage, it would be very funny. It's like Spinal Tap, only real. But yeah, she came along and basically handled a lot of stuff, from helping us get where we were going to holding on to the money and making sure that none of us died. So it was great. It was fun. I think we did 28 cities in 30 days. And everywhere I went, of course, I would meet people, and they'd be brandishing old Lemonheads records, and they'd say, I was here, for the first Lemonheads European tour, and you weren't here. Why weren't you here? And I was like, oh, God, how am I going to tell this story in a second language? But basically, there was a strange sense of this being a long overdue, hilarious victory lap / redemptive visit to all these now aging European fans who were telling me how much they had wished that I'd been on that Lemonheads tour that I opted out of.
Live in Innsbruck, Austria in 2007, and taken from the Live Varsity Drag album, Rock and Roll is Such a Hassle. Here's a rendition of the Lemonheads tune, Up.
Right, it seems like doesn't matter, but if we could
But it was a lot of fun. And one thing that we discovered was, and I don't want North America to take any offense at this, but in Europe, there is so much more enthusiasm regarding live music. Mm. The crowds are bigger. The level of joy and bouncing around is much higher. The clubs take care of you. They feed you. They give you booze. They usually have a dormitory, which is sometimes a very beautiful suite of like a hotel-style place where you can sleep at the club. It's so radically different from the experience I think the bands have touring in the United States that it was one of the reasons why we never really toured in the States, because we'd hear stories from people about basically the endlessly long drives, the complete absence of food or anything from clubs, and we were like, that's nuts. Mm. So yeah, Europe was awesome, and since our record label was over there in the UK with affiliates in Germany and Spain, they all were able to kind of set up this tour that took us all over the place and had support and promotion and all that. So it was loads of fun. And we got back, and everybody went back to their separate corners, and probably within a month or so, this cool punk rock lady up in Portland, Maine, where we lived, Naughty Sarah, sent me a message, and she said, hey, you know, I hear you have this band. We really want you to play at this club up there, Geno's. She was setting together some punk rock evening. Mm. So Lisa and I looked at each other. We're like, well, fuck it. Let's find a drummer. Let's play. We still have all these songs. We know them all. That was how this latest ongoing iteration of Varsity Drag got its feet under it. And we started playing shows then, and we have continued to play shows, not at a furious pace, but at a fairly regular pace since then. So, cripes, it's been 6-7 years now, I think. And so we did a second studio album, and we've also done an EP, a split 7-inch with a band from France. I think there's like 7 copies of that left in the world. That came out quite recently, but it was a limited run, so they're pretty much all gone. But, you know, there's an unlimited number of electronic versions of it. There's a live album that came from that first European tour that the record label insisted on putting out, which was very nice of them. I was kind of like, you sure? This is just the live recording. They're like, no, it's awesome. We want to make it into an album. Yeah, so that's where Varsity Drag is at. And again, we've actually been back over just to the UK, partly because I'm just a crazy Anglophile, and part of that's left over from being obsessed with literature for so many years. I just love England and all things English. And also because our record label's there, so they were always ready to say, hey, come on over, we'll set up a tour. Lots of good friends there, lots of great shows and opportunities for shows there. But for the most part, it has definitely been and will continue to be something that operates in my life on the level of a hobby. I mean, it's cheaper than scuba diving and skiing, I think. It's maybe a little bit more emotionally satisfying.
And there's not the threat of getting the bends.
Exactly. Well, probably not. I mean, I suppose if we were to play at very high elevation, we could get altitude sickness or edema or something. But until we are invited to play in C-Lab or something, we won't have to worry about the bends.
Here's the title track from Varsity Drag's superb second album, Night Owl.
I haven't worn a watch for months. The bedroom curtains tell the time. The sunset's never late. Climbing out of bed, I catch your smile in twilight coming down. The whole damn world can wait. The streets have sparked a light. Streaks of black and white. Come on, come on, let's stay up all night. Darkened doors and liquor stores, an orphan Andy's drawn a crowd. And there's still so much to see. Down to Mission, Noe Valley feels like uphill all the way. But I don't care if you're with me. And everything's alright. Clouds of fire bright. We're burning time at the speed of light. Such a lovely sight.
you just re-released the first three Lemonheads records with bonus stuff?
Yes! The reissue stuff was and is very exciting because not only did it involve fresh vinyl and remastering and stuff like that, also had all these bonus tracks, and the people at Fire Records, which right now is becoming one of my favorite labels, because also they have A Mission of Burma and Guided by Voices and a few other awesome acts. Like, we in one fell swoop became label mates with those bands. We were pretty proud of that. But Fire was very, very awesome about working with us to curate the songs and to choose the order and to choose what we were going to include and to work on liner notes and to check for accuracy and to do everything. So they really involved us at every stage of the process. And actually, one thing that I did in honor of the reissues was I dug up some old Super 8 movie footage that I had shot when Evan and I were living together, of us goofing around and of us on tour, and had it properly digitized and got a guy named Carl McNeil, who's an excellent editor, who actually edited the Great Big No video for Lemonheads in the 90s. Basically, he volunteered to take this footage and cut it together into music videos for those old songs.
Okay.
So we put together three music videos for songs that had previously never had a music video. Now, of course, if I had a brain on me, I would have tried to work out some exclusive with Brooklyn Vegan or Pitchfork or something to release the video. Instead, I just put it up on Vimeo and sent out something on Twitter and Facebook and was like, hey, check out these videos. So, I mean, I think the videos are awesome. They're a lot of fun, and you should go look at them if you want to see how everybody looked a million years ago. But yeah, it's been fun having the reissues done just because, again, I get to re-experience that music and think about that music. They put out, for Record Store Day, the most recent Record Store Day, they put out a double album, white vinyl, of live performances, two live performances, one from 87 and one from 88, done at a radio station in Boston. So the recording quality is really pretty good. They called it If Only You Were Dead, which was the working title of the song that became Mallow Cup, the first song on the third Lemonheads album, Lick. And it's so much fun, like, looking at this record and just seeing that all this is on vinyl now. The interesting thing, too, about that record was, and this is in terms of things that I don't remember, it turns out for a little while in the Lemonheads, we were a trio with John Strum playing drums, Evan playing guitar, and me playing bass and singing. I had absolutely no idea that I had ever been the bass player in the Lemonheads. But it turned out not only was I the bass player for a while, but we actually have this recording of a whole performance where I'm playing the bass and singing. And that is actually a pretty killer configuration. I was really kind of proud to have that stuff finally get released. I mean, because I'd forgotten a lot of it existed.
Yeah.
So yeah, those reissues are out there. We've talked a lot about doing some kind of tour in support of them where we play old Lemonhead songs, me and Evan and John or some coalition of the willing. It has not yet come together.
From the recently unearthed 1988 WERS session with Ben on bass, available on the Creator Deluxe Edition and the Record Store Day exclusive If Only You Were Dead, this is Fallen.
that you were in the studio with Ryan Adams and Evan doing a new Lemonheads record.
This is indeed true. I guess I can confirm that Jules and Evan and I all went out to LA and we did, in fact, do some recording. We actually fully tracked two songs. And then basically Evan and Juliana were touring immediately after that. Ryan Adams was recording his next record, which mm-hmm. is about to come out. And so it was sort of put in suspended animation. It may get picked up again in that form. It may not. I'm not sure. But Ryan, if you're listening to this, send me something with those songs because I've kind of forgotten what they came out sounding like. I remember they were really good. So anyway.
Ryan never misses an episode of this podcast.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Very nice guy. Excellent fella. As are they all. I mean, it is very interesting being a civilian hanging out with rock stars because, mm-hmm. as all of you may have suspected, they are all pretty much just batshit crazy, but very lovely, wonderful people. It's fun. It's one of the most interesting things about my early experiences with Lemonheads and being able to keep sort of a foot dipped in the water of music since then is that I've had the opportunity to meet so many people whose work I've always admired or people who, like, I grew up listening to their music. Mm-hmm. And the two satisfactions of working on music for me are having a song in my head and then actually making it take shape in such a way that I can hear it and I can hear exactly what I wanted to realize, just what I heard in my head. And that is just an amazing and very private delight, but that's the great satisfaction of it. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is just getting to meet these insanely amazing people, because sometimes when I think about all the people that I've met as a result of being involved in music, it would be like a wish list of everybody right. who I would ever have wanted to meet. And it's sweetened by the fact that a lot of the time you vaguely get this sense of like, yeah, we're sort of almost kind of peers, even though obviously we're not, but these mm-hmm. people are like, oh yeah, I know your songs. And mm-hmm. that's an astonishing feeling to have someone from the Pagans or the Angry Simones or something mm-hmm. like that be like, oh yeah, you guys. So yeah, I got nothing but gratitude for the whole thing, but I am grateful for having been spared a rock and roll life on the road in the 90s because I have seen it take a toll that is almost incalculable on a lot of people that I know and love, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. Mm. But those of you who wish for rock and roll fame won't listen to anything I'm saying anyway, so you'll continue on your quest. But yeah, as is the words of Philip Larkin, what does he talk about? Stumbling up the breathless stair to burst into fulfillment's desolate attic. There is something about a headlong rush after something where you might want to think about what it actually is like from one minute to the next, from one day to the next, if you achieve it. And if that's what you want, then great. But it's not like a story that ends with the phrase, lived happily ever after. Right. It's a story that sort of begins with the phrase, 10 months of the year on the road, right. waking up in a different city, sleeping in a van, mm-hmm. not having a wife or a girlfriend or a family or a dog or books or a piano or a neighborhood place you can walk to and get coffee every day. I mean, it's a lifestyle choice. And those of us who never wanted it and still don't want it just kind of endure the incredulity and shaking heads of other people. But mostly those people are people who never have experienced it. So I think what they think is being missed out on is very different from what is actually being missed out on. It's hard to talk about it in a way that conveys anything that makes any sense, but yeah, I babble anyway.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. Thanks for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Anybody out there who's listening, if you've heard any glaring inaccuracies, contact the creator of this podcast because it's entirely my fault and he'll post a correction because, you know, I don't remember anything. I sort of, a vague idea of events gets fixed in my head and then somebody asks me to tell the story of it and then I'll basically remember the story, which I read recently is sort of actually how the memory functions, that every right. time you call up a memory, you actually rewrite it,
yeah.
which is why you could actually program people to forget painful things or to remember nice things or vice versa if you wanted to torture them. And, you know, so
Through time, anecdotes get more and more refined.
Yeah, exactly. And probably less and less accurate. Mm. My serial memory has always been extremely piss poor. I mean, to the point where I have always had to rely on other people in my life, usually a significant other, to literally remember what year something happened, the order in which things happened. For instance, I can remember all the music that I hear. I remember lyrics. I remember poetry. I remember like big swaths of plays and Shakespeare and stuff. I can recite all that. I also remember spaces that I've been in. So I can close my eyes and I can imagine almost any apartment or place I've ever been in. I can like walk around it in my mind and picture where everything is. But when I try to remember events in sequence,
yeah,
I just basically can't do it. So I guess that's why the oral history aspect of it becomes important to me, because at least it gives me some vague sense of a narrative. But when I've seen friends, like my friend John Strome from Blake Babies and Lemonheads and various other things, he's now a very successful music attorney. He was writing a little blog a couple of years ago of sort of recollections of late 80s, early 90s, and he freaking remembers everything. Mm. And I don't understand how people can have such good memories. And I figure that at some point, before we all get too old, I need all of my friends to get together with me and tell me the stories of what they remember happening in my life, because I don't have a chance otherwise. I mean, so disclaimer attached. Right there.
And that's just about all the time we have for this week. I'd like to thank Ben and Lisa Diley for their kindness and hospitality in providing me and my tour mates with a place to crash. The Fire Records reissues of the first three Lemonheads records are available anywhere fine music is sold, and Pods and Varsity Drag releases can be acquired at their respective Bandcamp pages. For more information, check out bendiley.com. Be sure to tune in again next week when we'll hear an hour of songs about oceans. But before we go, from Varsity Drag's most recent release, the split 7-inch with Chestnut Road released last year, here's a song that speaks to the imprecision of Ben's memories, called Mind Like a Sieve. This is Charlie, signing off.